I'm very aware of all the eyes on us, but Sean seems oblivious. He asks,
Where are your colours?
Gabe went looking for them.
They're down on the beach, he says. You've got to pick them up down there.
Have you got yours?
Yes. I can hold Dove while you go get yours.
Dove shudders as someone touches her rump. It's too loud and too much for her. I'm worried that she'll use up all of her spirit here on the cliffs, long before we ever get down to the beach. I remember Peg Grattan telling me not to let anyone else tighten my girth on race day. Sean, I decide, is not anyone else. Can you make them leave her alone? He jerks a nod at me. In a low voice, so he has to lean his head toward me, I say, Thank you. Sean reaches between us and slides a thin bracelet of red ribbons over my free hand. Lifting my arm, he presses his lips against the inside of my wrist. I'm utterly still. I feel my pulse tap several times against his lips, and then he releases my hand.
For luck,
he says. He takes Dove's lead from me. Sean, I say, and he turns. I take his chin and kiss his lips hard. I'm reminded all of a sudden of that first day on the beach when I pulled his head from the water. For luck, I say to his startled face. A flashbulb goes off and there's appreciative hooting.
Okay, Sean says, as if we've just made a deal and it's all right to him. He turns to the crowd and says, If you want a race, you'll give this horse some room, now.
As they scatter outward, I push my way through them toward the cliff path. Before I head down, I look over my shoulder to find Sean, and there he is, with the wide berth around him and Dove, still watching me. I feel the island underneath me, and Sean's mouth on my lips, and I wonder if luck will be on our side today. Chapter 60 Puck The beach is not as crowded as I had expected. It's between two of the smaller races, and only the Kapalishka, who are entered in the next races, are on the beach. All of the spectators who were down on the sand before are now huddled up on the cliffs, pressed as close as they dare to the edge. The sky above them has cleared to a deep, deep blue like you only get in November. And the ocean to my right is dark as night. I can't think that I'll soon be racing beside it, or I won't be able to move. I quickly find the race officials' table in the shelter of the cliff. Two men in bowler hats sit behind a table with tantalizingly varied racing colors folded in front of them. I hurry across the sand and duck close so that I won't have to shout. I need to pick up my colors, I say. I recognize the man on the right. He sits near us in St. Columbus.
None left for you, replies the other official.
His crossed arms rest on a stack of them. I'm sorry, I ask politely.
None left, goodbye.
He turns to the official next to him and says,
What do you think of this weather? Warm, isn't it?
Sir, I say.
I'm not complaining about the heat, that's for sure. But it'll bring out the midges, says the other official.
You can't just pretend I'm not here, I say.
But they can.
They make pointed small talk, ignoring my presence, until I swallow my anger and humiliation and give up. I tell them that they're bastards, because they won't say anything back to me anyway, and go back the way I've come. I meet Gabe on his way down the cliff road. The wind has made his hair a mess.
Where are your colours? He asks.
I don't really want to confess it to him, but I do. They won't give them to me.
Won't?
I cross my arms over my chest. It doesn't matter. I'll race without them. But it does matter. A little.
I'm going to go talk to them, Gabe says.
His righteous anger is a welcome thing to see. Even if I don't think it will help. Sometimes it helps just to have it shared with another person.
This is stupid.
I watch him descend and cross the sand.
but I can tell from their faces as they watch him approach that he won't get a different answer. I tell myself it doesn't matter. I don't need to look like one of them. I don't need to belong.
Sod them,
Gabe says when he returns.
Old Thisby biddies.
Beside us, someone shouts out that everyone but the entrants in this last match race need to clear the beach, because it's nearly time for the final race. That means us.
Chapter 61. Sean. By the afternoon, the sun is strong but cold on the beach. The wind tears the surface of the blue-black sea into a thousand white caps. Up on the cliffs, there is the silhouette of a crowd, watching the pale road of sand between them and the ocean. Every so often, I can see the head of a Capel Ishker in the water, far out from shore, driven toward the sand by the November current. The ones we have caught struggle against us in bridles hung with bells and red ribbons, iron and holly leaves, daisies and prayers. The water horses are hungry and wicked, vicious and beautiful, hating us and loving us. It is time for the Scorpio races. I am so, so alive. Beneath me, Kor is powerful and restless. The sea sings to him in a way that it didn't yesterday, and when another Capel Ishker moves past us, he snaps at it. Before Puck, I'd never been so aware of how many of us there were on the beach for this race. Capel Ishker of every color pressing against each other, crushing, biting, snorting, kicking. The north end of the beach has never seemed so distant. In 18 furlongs and 5 minutes, this will all be over. I find Puck in the crowd. Unlike the others, she's not hanging last-minute baubles and trinkets onto her horse's mane. She's leaned over Dove's neck, her cheek pressed into Dove's mane.
Sean Kendrick!
I recognize Mutt's voice before I turn my head. He sits nearby on the piebald mare. When she tosses her mane, the bells he's braided in her mane ring a discordant chord. I don't see how he means for her to be fast under all the iron he has hanging off her breastplate and her crupper.
Don't talk to me, I say. This race is going to be hell for you,
Mutt replies. Kor lays his ears flat back and the piebald mare responds in kind. I say, you can't intimidate me on this beach. Mutt Malvern backs the piebald away. She jangles and snorts. He follows my gaze back to Puck.
I know what you care about, Sean Kendrick.
Puck. I'm trying unsuccessfully to pretend that this will be just another sprint. I'm trying not to look at how far we have to go. I'm trying to remember that I not only have to survive, but do well. I need to win. For a moment, I feel a pang of guilt, that if I get what I need, Sean doesn't. But maybe it doesn't have to be that way. If I win, surely there will be enough to both save the house and buy Kor. Puck, climb off for a moment. I'm surprised to hear Peg Grattan's voice. She stands at Dove's shoulder, looking up at me. Her hair is frazzled in the wind, and her face... serious. I obediently slide off. She's holding her Scorpio bird costume in her arms, a fact that I can't understand. How are you doing? Okay, I say. So terrible, she says. Gabe told me they wouldn't give you any colors. I shake my head. I won't let my face show anything. Peg says, right then, off with the saddle. Mystified but trusting. I pull off the saddle and watch Peg carefully unfold the costume in her arms. I see now that the great, terrifying bird head is no longer attached. It's just the back of the feather-covered cape. Peg lays it down on Dove's back, where the colors would have gone, and then she takes the saddle and looks to make certain that it won't chafe. Now, you wear Thisby's colors, she says. Thank you. Don't thank me. Peg's already walking away. Show them who you are. I swallow. Who I am is crouched down inside this girl named Puck Connolly, praying that I'll make it through the next few minutes. Riders, line up! How can it be time to line up? We've only just gotten down here, and I haven't seen Sean before the race. I swing onto Dove and stare over the Kapil Ishka, looking for him. If I can just see... On the other side of the line, I see him lifting his chin and looking at me as well. Cor, wearing dark blue colours, is slicked with sweat already. Sean's still looking at my face, so I lift up my wrist for him to see his ribbon on it. Riders, line up! I wish I were next to Sean and Cor, but there's no time. Three race officials are pressing us back into lines behind great wooden poles. The lines ring and shrill with hundreds of bells on dozens of hooves. The Kapil Ishka snap and snort, paw and shudder. I keep Dove as far from her neighbours as I can. Her ears are flattened back to her head. She's surrounded by predators. Beside me, the Kapil Ishka shakes its head and foam cascades down its neck and chest. They're counting down. The ocean says, shh, shh. They lift the poles. Chapter 62. Puck. We explode into action. There's no rhyme or reason. The only thing I can remember is to pull Dove to the inside. No one wants to be near that November sea, unless they have to be. Dove's hooves touch the edge of the surf, and salt water mists my face. Somehow, there is salt between my fingers and the reins, and the crystals burn and grate. Something crushes my leg, hard. The buckle of my stirrup leather grinding into the bone, and I turn in time to see a great bay Kapil Ishka pressed against me. I jerk Dove farther into the surf, just as the bay twists and snaps at her. Her ears flatten all the way back into her mane, just as I see that it's Gerald Finney. His fists are white-knuckled around his reins, and he doesn't glance at me. I can tell by the shiver working through the saddle that Dove recognizes his Kapil. I clamp my legs on either side of her. Don't be afraid yet, Dove. We have a long way to go. I remember, too late, that I'm supposed to be conserving Dove's energy, and I check her speed. Horses charge by us. The green of Ian Privet's colours, the light blue of Blackwell's, the gold of the piebald mare. No red stallion under dark blue, though. I have no idea if he is so far ahead that I can't see him, or if he is behind me.
Sean. I look for Puck or Dove, but I can't see anything in this crush of bodies. Cor strong in my hands. My exhausted shoulders already ache from the weight of him. My calves burn with the friction of the stirrup leathers. I'm not sure how long I should hold Cor back behind the pack to look for her. The back is the worst place to be. The Kapil back here lag not because they're slow, but because they're fighting with each other or fighting with the sea. The hooves in front of me kick sand into my face. My eyes sting, but I can't spare a hand to swipe at them. To my left are a grey and a chestnut tearing at each other. They try to incorporate Cor into the skirmish. I hold him true and press him forward. Not too far, because if Puck is behind me, I don't want to leave her behind. My hands are buried in the sweaty mane at his withers, and I feel his muscles shaking at the touch of the November sea. I whisper at him to be steady. I look under my arm to the right for Puck. There's nothing but the grey halfway into the surf. He's already mostly a creature of the sea. His eyes are slits in his lengthening head. The grey twists and scrabbles, more anxious for the rider on his back than the race before him. Seawater sprays from somewhere, the cold of it like claws on my cheek. Another Kapil pushes on my left side.
She snaps out and grazes my leg before her rider jerks her away. I can't stay back here. I'll get out in the open and find Puck. If she's not out of this rabble by now, she might already be dead. I lean over Kor's neck to whisper to him, but for once, I can't think of what to whisper. But it doesn't matter. Kor knows what I want without me having to speak, and he surges out of the bunched capel in the rear. There is a narrow corridor open right to the very front, where the three frontrunners are fighting it out. Last year I would have been through that hole with Kor, and they would have been counting the lengths between the rest of the pack and Kor for the remainder of the race. But I don't take that move. I wait.
Puck. It only takes a minute for Dove to be bitten, and another few seconds for me to be cut by some razor-sharp edge that I don't think can be horse teeth. I don't have time to look at the wound or guess what has cut me. We're trapped in a crush of bodies. Even over the rush of the wind in my ears, I hear their squeals and roars, the clucks and growls as they fight. From the slice in my thigh, I feel the disconcerting heat of blood running down my leg, but no pain yet. Whatever cut me was sharp enough that the wound was clean. Dove is beginning to panic. Movement to her right makes her jerk her head sharply enough that the rain rips open one of the searing blisters on my palm. I see white all the way around Dove's eyes. I need to get out of here. Sand stings my cheeks and the corners of my eyes, but I can't spare a hand to swipe my skin. I don't see how we can move forward until the Capel Ishka to my right charges into the ocean, tripping over the waves, twisting in the air before throwing its rider. It's Finny. I see his eyes meet mine for a bare second, his hands pedaling through the water, and then his bay Capel's dull teeth snap shut on his cheekbone. Then I'm past them, and they're gone, and it's only seething water that sprays a dark pattern on Dove's shoulder. And I'm sick, sick, sick. Suddenly, there is a narrow path where before there was a Capel Ishka. If I pull through the right, using some of Dove's precious strength, we might get clear. It won't do any good to save her speed if we die in this fight. I press my calves into her hot sides, and suddenly it clicks. Dove finds her stride, and we pull free of the little tempestuous pack that we were trapped in. And there, hanging behind the leaders, I see a red stallion under blue colours. And Sean Kendrick, folded neatly on top of him. I sweep blood off the bite on Dove's shoulder. It's not deep, but guilt pricks me anyway. I say sorry to her, and she flicks a trembling ear back. I let out a barest length of rein. She's still terrified, but for a moment, I have her attention. Focus. I think about riding on the cliffs, holding her steady, keeping her even. I remember the Ishka mare leaping from the edge of the cliff. The secret is to remember the race while the others forget everything but the ocean. I can be steady.
Sean. There's a newcomer on our right, and Kor, mad at the touch of the sea, snakes his head to bite at them. I check him, and the horse beside us jerks but holds steady. Black-tipped ears, smaller than Kor, smaller than any of the horses on this beach. Ordinary muscles pumping and moving beneath her skin. It's Duff, matching us stride for stride, feathers fluttering on her saddle pad. I glance once and then again at Puck and then Dove. Dove's been bitten, but not deep. Puck's bleeding too, but unlike Dove's untidy bite wound, Puck's is clean and long, the material of her breeches sliced. It was a knife that did that, not a horse. Someone angry that she was on the beach with us. To think too long on that is to be furious, and to be furious is to lose focus, which I can't afford. Because in front of us is chaos. The worst of it is the noise, the panting of winded Capel, the groaning as they fight, the continuous thunder of the hooves, the hissing of the sea, the squeals and the shouts, and behind it all, the screams of the crowd. The noise would drive a horse mad, even if the November ocean didn't. A capel in front of us twists and wheels inward, its rider avoiding the ocean at all costs. Another two shove and squabble, slowing enough that we move past them. It's a wall of hocks and knees and hooves, blood coating bone, teeth against teeth. They make an attempt to bring us into it, but Kor blocks them, a trembling wall between them and Dove, who is a wall between him and the sea. We are over halfway there. Halfway means we've made it a little over a mile. The first half weeds out those who weren't ready, those who weren't tame. It's a rite of passage. I look at Puck, and she looks back at me, expression fierce. The sand blurs below us, and the ocean becomes silent in comparison to the sounds of our lungs gasping for breath. We are the only two on the sand. Blackwell's and Privet's mounts quarrel up at the front. They worry back and forth, teeth flashing, necks and shoulders rubbing. Just behind them, Mutt Malvern relentlessly beats Scarter, the piebald. And still Puck moves up behind them, steady and even. I match Kor to Dove, stride for stride, and with each stride we gain ground. Kor has nothing but power left. There is a path ahead. I could cut ahead of Blackwell and then Privet. Mutt is nothing at all as he drops back from the lead and closer to us. I could be in the lead and taking this win as easily as I snatched it last year. In 3 minutes, Kor could be mine. Everything I've ever wanted. A roof over my head and reins in my hands and a horse beneath me. Kor. I feel the mare goddess's breath in my face. I told Puck I would stay until she made her move. Maybe she doesn't have the speed to overtake the leaders. Maybe I give everything away by waiting. I tell myself I have time still. I have time for Kor to push forward. Dove begins to make her move. I realize then that Mutt Malvern has pulled Scarter back intentionally. He never meant to win.
Puck. The piebald's attack takes me by surprise. Between me and the sea, she rears back, as if she means to plunge forward. But then she drops onto Dove, her teeth close down over Dove's pole, right behind her ears. Dove staggers. I turn my head and look right into Mutt Malvern's ghastly grin. I hear Sean shout, his voice unstrung. This is between you and me, Mutt! Trying to keep my stirrups, I lean far forward up Dove's sweaty neck to grab at the piebald's ear. Her skin feels slippery and unlike any horse I've ever touched. Dove's spine presses hard into my guts, and my blistered hand aches. But I ignore all of that and twist the piebald's ear sharply. She squeals and drops off Dove. I barely understand Sean's shout. Get out of the way, Puck! Dove understands, even if I don't. As Kor presses closer, she shoots from between him and the piebald. I barely have time to drop back down into the saddle, the leather slick with blood or water beneath me. Scarter twists and leaps beneath Mutt, but we are free of her. I glance behind me and only have time to see Kor's shoulder smashing up against the piebald mare's. Sean's gaze flicks toward me for a second. He's watching to make sure that I'm moving. I want to wait for him. I know he's won this 4 times without me here, but I don't want to leave him. I hear Sean Kendrick's voice. Go! I let Dove's reins go.
Sean. We can't get clear. Kor could outstrip Scarter if we could pull ahead, but Mutt Malvern has seized my rein. He drags Kor's face toward him, within reach of the piebald's teeth. It's Kor's blindside, and he is wild with the fear of not knowing what he's up against. His eyes roll, his nose jerks into the air again and again. Scarter snaps at him, her teeth grating against his cheek.
As I fight Mutt for Kaur's rein, my knee crashes into Mutt's bone to bone, searing hot. Skarta and Kaur gallop, shoulder to shoulder, every step taking us farther into the surf. I taste salt water. My saddle is slimy with it. Every muscle in Kaur's body shivers and shimmers. Glancing to Mutt, I see that he's having a hard time keeping his seat. Too late. I see his knife. I lift my arm. I cannot protect myself or Kaur. It's not me he stabs. He slides it along the piebald's neck, slicing a scarlet line. She is furious with pain. "Manage this, Kendrick," Mutt says. He lets go of the reins. Skarta slams into us.
Puck. We catch up to Blackwell and Margot first. She's a big, lean bay, long as a train car, and she fights him hard. I see that her mouth is cracked open and grinning like the black Kapil Ishka that found us in the lean-to. She was breathlessly fast before, but now he holds her tightly in check. When Blackwell tries to allow her some more rein, she darts toward the ocean. But Dove cares nothing about the sea. I lean low over her mane. Her neck is sweaty and my hands are sweaty, and it's hard to keep my grip. And I ask her for more. She slides past Blackwell. There is only Privet and Pender ahead of us now. He's keeping a good distance between him and the surf, and I could move up between them. But if I could push Pender closer to that November water, maybe I could distract him long enough to hold the lead. It would mean getting very close to a Kapil Ishka without any escape plan, and Dove is already frightened to the breaking point. It's not much farther. Only 3 furlongs, maybe. I don't want to hope, but I can feel it pumping through me. Only, Kaur should be here now. I shouldn't be up here with Pender by myself. When I glance behind me, I can't see him. I can see Margot gaining on us fast, and the feathers of Dove's makeshift saddle colours flapping crazily in the wind. I hear Sean's voice saying that this is possible, and Peg Grattan telling me to show them who we are. I know that it is not about Dove being brave in the end. It's about me being brave for her. I lean over Dove's neck. Dove, my best friend. And I ask her for one last burst of speed.
Sean. I am holding Kaur, but I am holding nothing. Somewhere there is a high, clear scream, and then I'm falling. In the moment between Kaur's back and the surf, I think first of the dozens of horses behind us, and then of my father's death. My only chance is if I can get clear, to hope that when I hit that ground, I hit it so that I can roll free of most of the hooves to come. If I stay conscious, I might survive. For one moment, I see everything with perfect clarity. Kaur, his face a mask of red, one of his nostrils torn, the horizon stretching away far out of reach, the blue, blue November sky above us. The piebald's knee lurches up to strike my head. When I hit the sand, my vision breaks like a wave. I have the surf in my mouth, and the sand beneath me rumbles with hoofbeats, and there is red, red, red above me.
Chapter 63. Puck. The moment we pass Ian Privet and Pender, Ian meets my eyes, and I see that he doesn't believe it. But then, the race is over. Even when I see that we have crossed the line first, even when it's another half second before Margot flashes by, and another second before Ake Paulson and Dr. Halsall crash by nose to nose, I can't believe it. I slow Dove, patting her neck, laughing and rubbing away tears with the back of my bloody hand. All of my pains melted away. All that remains are ceaseless shivers. I stand shakily in my stirrups, steering her away from the other Kapil Ishka as they cross the finish. Greys and blacks
and chestnuts and bays. I don't see Sean. My ears won't stop hissing. It takes me a long moment to realize that it's the audience roaring from up above. They're shouting my name and Dove's. I think I hear Finn among them, but maybe I imagine it. And still, there are the water horses at the end of the race, milling and rearing and twisting. But I don't see Sean. A race official comes toward me, his arm out toward Dove's bridle. My hands won't stop shaking. I have a terrible feeling inside me. Congratulations, the official says. I look at him, waiting for what he just said to make sense. And then I ask, where's Sean Kendrick? When he doesn't answer me, I turn Dove back the way we came. The beach at this end is a mess of sweaty Kapil Ishka and tired riders. The beach looks nothing like what it looked like to me galloping the other direction. It is nothing but a stretch of sand when I'm trotting. The ocean is only wave after wave, not a hungry, dark thing. I direct Dove back the way we came, scanning the wet sand. There are smears of blood where fights went down, and a dead chestnut Kapil lying very close to the water. They're putting a sheet over someone farther inland, which makes my stomach squeeze, but it's too big to be Sean. And then I see Cor, standing at the edge of the surf, reflected red in the wet sand beneath him. One of his hind legs is crooked under him, resting on the toe of the hoof. His head is curled low, and as I get closer, I see that he's trembling. His saddle has been pulled around so that it hangs nearly upside down. There's a dark, slender form beneath him, the reins all tangled around it. Even filthy, I recognize the blue-black jacket, and the red I mistook for reflection is merely blood, slowly being washed away with each wave. I think, suddenly, of how Gabe said that he could not bear it, and I didn't believe him. Because, of course, you could bear anything if you decided to. But just then, I understand him perfectly, because I cannot bear it if Sean Kendrick is dead. Not after all this. Not after everyone else. It is bad enough to see Cor standing there with a leg I think is broken. But Sean cannot be dead. I slide off Dove. There's another race official, and I press my reins into his hands. I scramble across the sand toward Cor. I slow for a moment as a gull swoops close to my face. They're already gathering around the carnage on the beach. Why doesn't someone chase them away? Sean? As I get close, I startle backward at a sudden movement. It's Sean. He reaches up an arm, fumbling. Finding the stirrup, he uses it to heave himself up. He's unsteady as a new colt. I throw my arms around him. I can't tell which of us is shaking. Sean's voice is hoarse. Did you do it? I don't want to tell him, 'cause it was only half of what was supposed to happen. He pulls back and looks at my face. I'm not sure what he sees there, but he says, yes. Pender was second. Where were you? What happened? Mud, Sean says. He looks out to the ocean, his eyes narrowed. Did you see him? No, I didn't think so. She took him. The piebald took him. My wounds are starting to hurt, and my stomach feels tight. He never meant to win. He just wanted you. Cor stood here, Sean says, wonderingly. I would have died. He didn't have to stay. For a moment, I see that it doesn't matter that he didn't win. The fact of Cor's loyalty is a bigger thing than the ownership of him. Then I watch his eyes sweep over Cor, taking in his lowered head, the blood on his nostrils, the twist of the hind leg. From here, it looks terrible enough that my guts lurch. Sean steps forward
and carefully touches Kor's hind leg, running his hand along it.
I see the precise moment when Sean's hand stops,
and his shoulders slope, and I know it is broken. I remember what Sean wished for, to get what he needed. And at that moment, I don't see how I can believe in any god or goddess or island at all. And if I do, how I could believe them to be anything but cruel. Sean moves away and jerks up the girth so that the twisted saddle falls to the ground, leaving Kor bare and dark red, his hair curly and damp where the saddle had been. Sean runs his hand over the sweat-curled hair. Then he twists a handful of Kor's mane into his hand and presses his forehead against Kor's shoulder. I don't need him to tell me that Kor will never run again. Chapter 64. Puck. The rest of the day passes in a rush. There are prize ceremonies and money, journalists and tourists. There are congratulations and handshaking and so many voices that I can't hear any of them. There's tending for my cut. My, that's nasty, Puck Connolly. And how did a horse give you that? You're lucky it's not deep. And pampering of Dove. It goes on for hours and hours, and I can't get away from any of it to anything important. After the sun has disappeared, I learn that Kor has been given a makeshift shelter in one of the coves on the beach because he cannot walk back to the Malvern Yard. I manage to escape from the mob and make it part way down the cliff path. There, in the twilight, I see Sean Kendrick sitting against the cliff, eyes closed. And I would have gone to him. But fair-haired George Holly is already shaking him awake and coaxing him away. Even from here, I see that Sean's expression is wrecked by everything that he's lost. Holly gives me a far-off nod to send me on, but it's not until Sean meets my eyes that I lead Dove back toward home. Finn catches up to me on the way home, skipping a little until he falls into step with me. His hands are stuffed into the pockets of his jacket. For a few moments, we walk in silence. The only sounds the pad of our feet on the dirt, and Dove's hooves occasionally chipping pebbles as she walks. Dusk makes everything seem smaller around us. "You're frowning," he says, finally. I know he's right. I can feel the furrow between my eyebrows. I'm counting, that's why. There's not much joy in it, though. The numbers always come up the same. Enough for us to save the house. Not enough for Sean to buy Kor, even if Malvern would let him. Finn says,
"You should be celebrating. Gabe says he's making a feast for us at home."
Even after this long day, he can't keep the spring out of his own step. He's like a colt on a windy day. I do my best to keep the sting out of my words, because none of this is Finn's fault, but a crumb of bitterness creeps in. I can't celebrate while Sean Kendrick's down there with a broken horse he can't afford because of me.
"How do you know Sean Kendrick even wants him still?"
I don't have to be told. I know Sean still wants Kor. It's never been about the racing. Finn glances over and gets my answer in my expression.
"All right, then," he says. "Why can't he afford him?"
Saying it out loud makes it worse, though. I explain. Sean had to win to get the rest of the money. He didn't have enough. For a long moment, there's just a slap of our shoes again. The scrape of Dove's hooves. The wind gusting across our ears. I wonder if Holly's taken Sean away from the beach. I wonder if Sean will sleep down there. He's usually so pragmatic, but not where Kor's concerned.
"Why don't we give him some money?"
asks Finn. I swallow. I didn't win enough for both the house and Kor. Finn rummages in his pocket.
"We can use this!"
When I see the fat wad of bills in his hand, I stop so fast that Dove rams her head into my shoulder. I demand, Finn! Finn Connolly, where did you get that? I can see that Finn's having to try very hard not to show me a smile. The effort of it gives him the frog face like nobody's business. I can't stop looking at the roll of money in his hand, nearly as fat as the purse for the race. He says,
45 to 1.
It takes me a long moment to puzzle out where I recognize the number from. The chalkboard at Grattan's. Suddenly, I understand where the rest of the money from the biscuit tin went. You gambled on... I can't even finish the sentence. Finn starts walking again, and now there's a bit of strut to it. He says,
Dory Maud said you were a good bet.
Chapter 65. Puck. My mother always told me that you should wear your best clothing when you're angry, because it would scare people. I'm not angry, but I'm in the mood to be terrifying, so I take great care in the morning after the races. I spend an hour before my mother's oval mirror in her room, turning my ginger hair around a brush and twisting the curls with my fingers. I keep an image of Peg Grattan's hair in my head as I sort it all out. There turned out to be much less of it when it was all going in the same direction, and when I pin it back, I see my mother's face in the mirror. I go to her closet and look at her dresses, but none of them look like they would scare anyone. So instead, I find a collared shirt and put on a pair of breeches and my boots after I polish all of the beach that was caked on them. I borrow her coral bracelet and her matching coral necklace. Then I step out into the hall. Kate, Gabe says, startled. He sits at the kitchen table and stares. I heard him packing last night.
Where are you going?
I'm going to the Malvern Yard.
Well, you sure do look nice.
I open the door. Outside, the morning is pastel and mild, scented with wood smoke, as soft as yesterday was hard. I know. I strap my school bag over my back and take the bicycle because Dove has earned a day off if she's earned anything. And I bike through the benevolent day to the Malvern Yard. As before, when I get to the yard, it is bustling with activity. Grooms with horses going out to pasture, riders taking thoroughbreds out to the gallops for their run, stable boys sweeping down the cobbles.
Kate Connolly, says one of the grooms. Sean's not here.
I didn't think he would be, but I don't like to hear it anyway. Still, I say, I'm looking for Benjamin Malvern, actually.
He'll be up at the house. Is he expecting you?
Yes, I say, because if he wasn't expecting me before, he'll be expecting me when I walk in.
Well then, let me, says the groom.
He pulls open the gate for me and my bicycle. I thank him and walk my bicycle up to the Malvern house. It sits behind the stable and is a big, grand old thing. Like Malvern himself, it's impressive and powerful looking, but not particularly handsome. I lean my bicycle against the wall and walk to the front door and knock. For a long moment, there is no answer. And then Benjamin Malvern opens the door. Good morning, I say. And I step past him into his center hall. It is a naked thing, just wide open ceiling and a little drawing room table against the wall. I see a sitting room beyond it and a single cup sitting in the middle of a white tablecloth.
I was just having tea, he says.
Good timing then, I reply.
I don't wait for him to invite me and instead step into the sitting room.
Like the center hall, it's nearly empty. Just a round table in the middle of a high-ceilinged room with nothing but brass sconces on the walls. It seems rather lonely. I wonder if he was just sitting in here, wondering if the sea would ever spit out the piebald or Mutt Malvern again. I sit in a chair opposite to the one already ajar. Malvern's mouth works.
Milk and sugar.
I fold my arms on the table and eye him. I'll have what you're having. He raises an eyebrow
before making me a cup of his odd tea. He pushes it to me and settles down opposite, crossing his legs and leaning back.
What brings you blowing into my house like a hurricane, Kate Connolly? It's quite rude.
I expect it is. I've come for three things, really, I say. I tip the cup against my lips, and he watches me. I close one eye. The tea is almost precisely like drinking a scone, or licking the carpet. Three things I'd like.
That's quite a lot of things to like.
I reach into the school bag and place a small stack of notes on the tablecloth. The first thing I'd like to do is pay everything owed on the house. Malvern eyes the money, but doesn't touch it.
And the second?
I take another big drink of tea for emphasis. It requires quite a bit of heroics on my part, but I manage. I'd like you to give me a job. He sets down his teacup.
And what is it you think you'll do in this job?
I think I'll probably muck stalls and ride horses and push wheelbarrows to start. And I think I'll be good at it. Balvern considers me.
Jobs are not the easiest thing to be had on this island, you know.
So I've heard, I reply. Benjamin Malvern rubs his fingers over his mouth and looks up at the empty ceiling high above us. There's a bit of a crack in the plaster, and he frowns at it.
I think I could manage that. And what is your third thing you'd like?
I set down my teacup and look at him quite hard. If I am ever to look terrifying, this is the moment. I would like you to sell Core to Sean Kendrick, even though Sean didn't win. Malvern makes a face.
We had a bargain, he and I, and he knew it.
That horse is useless to you, and both of you know it. What is it you think to do with him? He opens one of his hands skyward. I say, so you might as well sell him, unless you just fancy tormenting Sean Kendrick. I consider adding, like your late son fancied, but figure that might be more foul than the situation requires.
Did he ask you to ask me?
I shake my head. He doesn't know I'm here, and he might feel a little odd if he knew that I was. Malvern looks into his tea.
You two are a strange pair. You are a pair, aren't you?
We're in training. He shakes his head.
Fine. I'll sell him. But the price isn't changing just because the horse stands on three legs instead of four now. Is that all from you?
I said three things, and that's what I gave you.
Indeed it is. Well then, leave me to my tea. Come back on Monday, and we can talk about your wheelbarrow.
I stand up, leaving the notes sitting untouched on the table, and head out into the yard. The breeze runs long and low across the ground, sweeping up the sea, and the island grass, and the hay, and the horses. I think it's the best smell in the world.
Chapter 66 Sean. The November sea is a jewel in the evening, dark and glittering beyond the ruddy stones. Cor and I leave the white cliffs behind us as I lead him toward the water. As when I first pulled him from the sea, he wears just a rope halter. I have long since pulled the wrap from his hind leg. It won't heal him. Holly tells me that they have ways in California of setting the bone, but that he'd still never race again. He tells me that there's nothing more foolish than for me to buy Cor, only to turn him back into the ocean. But Cor could no sooner go to California than he could fly. And in any case, I'm uncertain what a life like that would hold for a Kapil Ishka. He loves the sea and to run, and while I could give him one of those things, we were happy. And so now I walk him slowly down to the surf. In the sea, his clumsiness will disappear, his weight cradled by the salt water, and he won't notice so much that his hind leg is not what it was. I don't want to say goodbye. Back by the cliffs, Puck Connolly and George Holly wait for me, both of them with their arms crossed over their chests, their postures identical. They give me this moment alone, and I'm grateful for it. Despite his painful progress, Kaw's ears prick to the sea. This November ocean sings sweetly to him, luring him and caressing him, quickening his blood. Together we step into the frigid water. In this light, he's red like the sun before night, a giant, a god. His ear flicks back as the ocean plays over his injured leg and then back out to the horizon. The sea out there is black and depthless, hiding more wonders, perhaps, than even the waters of Thisbe. It wasn't that long ago that Kaw and I splashed in this surf, here at the base of these cliffs. Now he couldn't even take a step without thought. I run my hands down his neck, over his withers, down his shoulder. It's something I'd taken for granted, just the presence of him. I rest my cheek against his shoulder, my eyes closed for just a second, and then I whisper to him, "Find happiness." Then I can't stand, because my legs won't hold me here a moment longer. I blink to clear my vision and reach up. I pull off his halter. I back out of the surf, watching him. His ears are still pricked on the horizon, not toward me. The ocean is his love, and now, finally, he'll have it. I flip up my collar and turn my back to him as I pick my way back up toward the cliff base. I don't think I can watch him disappear into the water. It will break my heart. Puck's scrubbing her eyes busily as if she has something in them. George Holly bites his lip. The cliffs tower above me and I try to console myself. I will find another Kapil Ishka. I will ride again. I will move to my father's home and be free. But there's no comfort in my thoughts. Behind me, the ocean says, "Shh." There's a thin, long wail. I keep walking, my bare feet slow on the uneven stones. The wail comes again, low and keening. Puck and Holly are looking past me, so I turn around. Still at the shoreline, Kaw has noticed my going, and he stands where I left him, looking back at me. He lifts his head again and keens to me. The irresistible ocean sucks around his hooves, but still he looks over his withers at me and he wails, again and again. The hair on my arms stands with his call. I know he wants me to go to him, but I can't go with him where he needs to go. Kaw falls silent when I do not come to him. He looks back out to the endless horizon. I see him lift a hoof and put it back down. He tests his weight again. Then Kaw turns, stepping out of the ocean. His head jerks up when his injured leg touches the ground, but he takes another labored step before keening to me again. Kaw takes another step away from the November sea, and another. He is slow, and the sea sings to us both, but he returns to me. This is Steve West. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of The Scorpio Races by Maggie Steve Otter. This program was produced and directed by Bob Dion. Executive producer Paul R. Gagne. Original music composed and arranged by Maggie Steve Otter. Performed by Maggie Steve Otter and Kate Hummel. Text copyright 2011 by Maggie Steve Otter. Production copyright 2011 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Author's note. This is Maggie Steve Otter. As a teen, I was always intrigued when I read articles about authors mulling over story ideas for months or years before they knew how to write them. As a teen writer who scribbled down novel ideas as soon as they came to her, this seemed quaint and foreign. How could you not know how to write your own story, I thought, as I dashed out another terrible novel in a month. Well, here I am, being one of those authors. I have wanted to write about water horses for a very long time. I've actually attempted it several times. First while in college, then again right after. I'd almost given up, but a few years ago, after I'd published 3 novels and really should have known what I was doing, I threw myself at the legend one more time. And failed, again. The only difference to this failure was that it was not a bang, as before, but a whimper. The problem was that the myth was both complicated and plotless, with no inherent narrative to guide a daunted author. There were rather a lot of variations. A Manx version called Glashtin, Irish versions called Capel Ushka, Capel Ushti, and Akiski, Scottish versions called Ach Ushka and Kelpies. Apart from being nearly universally impossible to pronounce, the name I went with is pronounced Capel Ishka, the main feature of each was a dangerous fairy horse from the water. There were many magical elements that appealed to me. The horses were associated with November. They ate flesh. If you lured them away from the ocean, they made the finest mounts imaginable. Unless they touched salt water again. But then there was also an eerie shape-shifting element to the myth. Some versions involved a water horse turning into a handsome young man with chestnut hair. The newly minted young man would wander by the waterside, luring maidens closer, because of course there is nothing more irresistible than a strange red-headed boy who smells vaguely of fish, and then drag the victims down into the water to devour them. Lungs and liver would wash up later. It was the second half that slayed me. Every time I tried to work in the creature, both man and horse, I realized I was telling a story I didn't want to tell. It wasn't until I wrote the Shiver trilogy, with its rather corrupted version of the werewolf legend, that I realized I didn't have to take the water horses at face value. I could be as choosy as I liked with my mythology. I threw out absolutely everything that I didn't need about the water horses and ended up with the Scorpio races, a story that isn't really about water horses or fairies at all, now that I think about it. Now, if you'd like to find out more about the creepy red-headed water boys with kelp in their hair, I urge you to hunt down a copy of Catherine Briggs' An Encyclopedia of Fairies, Hobgoblins, Brownies, Bogies, and Other Supernatural Creatures, which is an excellent starting point for all things fairy. I suppose it's still possible I might one day write the other half of the legend. No, actually, no, it's not. As a child, I was always fascinated with horses, and we had horses growing up. Some of them were not the nicest horses in the world. And so when I found a legend about the water horses, evil water horses, in an old, dusty fairy book in the library, I was greatly intrigued. The first thing I thought was, wow, this is magical. And the second thought was, I think I own one of these. So a water horse is an interesting and fascinating fairy creature. A lot of fairy legends have to do with people, and a lot of fairy legends have to do with animals, and the water horse is one of the legends that perfectly combines both of them. It has a shape-shifting element, where these horses turn into men, who have particular fairy taboos, where you cannot spend time with them or you will die. But they also have a very wild element, which has to do with the setting that they're associated with. In this case, the water. Every November, the water horses would plunge from the ocean and gallop up and down the beach looking for a fresh kill, which they would drag back into the water with them. Of course, as a lot of things fairy, they're equally good and bad, and so if you could tame these horrible horses and bring them inland out of the touch of the sea, they would make an amazing horse for your races or for your breeding stock. So I guess that was what first intrigued me about them. I really loved how they were equal parts terrible and awesome. There are a couple of differences between traditional water horse mythology and what I used in the book. The big difference, of course, is that I threw out all the shape-shifting component. I took out where they turned into handsome young men that would lure the victims into the water because, for me, shape-shifting as a metaphor is really about identity, and I had covered that with the Shiver trilogy and my werewolves. But I would say it's not that there's so many differences between the water horses that are found in mythology and the water horses that are found in the Scorpio races. It's that I added a lot.